This is the Ingles Information Aisle with Leah McGrath, helping you eat healthy, feel great, and understand your nutrition. Now, here's your host, Ingles dietitian Leah McGrath.
Good Saturday morning. Welcome to the Ingles Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingles dietitian, and I have a very special guest in the studio with me today. Somebody who's going to kind of walk and talk us through some of the issues around farming and agriculture, and also about some of the labels that we see on our food when we're in Ingles shopping. So I want to introduce everybody to Jack Britt, and Jack is joining us here in the studio today. Good morning, Jack. How are you?
Good morning, Leah. Great to be here today.
So you're not just simply Jack Britt. I mean, you are Jack Britt, but you've got quite a resume of accomplishments and experience in the world of agriculture, farming, especially in the dairy realm. So can you give everybody a little bit of a peek at your CV?
Sure, Leah. You know, I think of myself still as a farm boy. I grew up on a family farm in Kentucky, dairy farm. Went to study agriculture with the intent of going back to the farm. And some of my professors encouraged me to go ahead for further study. And I ended up going to graduate school. And after that, I taught at agricultural universities, three major universities around the country as a teacher and scientist. And so I've worked with farmers all over the United States and in 21 countries around the world. I still work with farmers almost every day.
Do you ever wish you still had a dairy farm? Or it's not in the family anymore, right?
No, it's not in the family. And in many ways, I sort of have my farm and don't have it because I get to work with so many farmers in different settings and circumstances. I almost feel like I have farms, but they belong to someone else. And I enjoy helping farmers and working with farmers wherever they are.
So you mentioned that you've worked at three major universities, and one of them, because a lot of our listeners are very passionate about their local universities, you worked at NC State, right?
That's right. I worked at the University of Tennessee, and I also worked nearby at the University at NC State and the University of Tennessee. So both of those are nearby.
Who do you root for when you're?
I'm a Wolfpack fan because I spent 25 years of my career at NC State.
So my husband would have a hard time with that because he's all about, you know, Chapel Hill and everything.
So. I had a daughter that went to Chapel Hill, so I can appreciate
that. So, you know, I get, as a dietitian for Ingles, some people are always curious about, you know, why I am so interested in talking about agriculture and farming. And for me, I feel like it's almost impossible to separate agriculture and farming from talking to people about what's on their plate. Because if people have concerns or fears about where their food is coming from or how it's produced, it's very hard to convince them to eat different things, like whether it's fruits and vegetables or drink milk or eat beef or chicken, if they don't feel comfortable about what they're eating or how it was being raised. So that's why you're here, Jack, so you can help me to help others.
Sure. You know, three or four generations ago, almost everyone had direct links or very close links to the farm. Now, three or four generations later, we're pretty separated from what goes on at the farm every day, even though our granddads and grandmoms and great-grandparents maybe were farmers. And so we lose that link back to our past.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not trying to poke fun at everybody, but I hear stories of farmers who, when they go to a state fair, one of my friends is a farmer, and she said she had one of her calves there, and they were exhibiting it. And she said this little boy walked up with his dad, and he said, "Daddy, what's that?" And he said, "It's a pig, son." And he didn't know. He didn't know what it was. And because they, you know, I'm sure he didn't grow up on a farm or didn't grow up around a farm. So we are very separated from how animals are raised. And things have really changed as well. We can't really neglect saying that, you know, even if you did grow up on a farm 30 or 40 years ago, how farming practices are very different than they were 30 or 40 years ago, right?
Sure. You know, I taught at Michigan State in my first job, and about a third of my students were from the Detroit area who had never been on a farm before. But they had to take my class in order to be able to be admitted to veterinary school.
Oh.
So I had some really great questions from kids who didn't know anything about livestock.
Bet.
And this was their first class. So it was a learning experience for me in terms of teaching them, and obviously learning experience from them.
Well, and you'll appreciate this one. There was recently an article that I shared from one of my friends that one of the misconceptions that people have is they think that chocolate milk comes from brown cows. Have you ever heard that one?
I've heard that lots of times.
And I heard that about brown eggs, that people think a brown egg is going to taste different than a white egg, and it's just based on the breed of the chicken.
It sure is.
So and if you're listening and and hopefully you know that chocolate milk doesn't come from brown cows because strawberry milk doesn't come from pink cows. Just so we put that out there. So we want to try and do some kind of clarification of some of the terms that – starting out with some of the farming terms. So, Jack, what's the difference? What's a hybrid when we talk about plants? And what's an heirloom? Can you
sure.
tell everybody?
Well, let's start with heirloom.
Okay.
Heirloom really means a historic vegetable or fruit or crop that was grown generations ago. Now, even the heirloom crops, the tomatoes and the peaches and so on, were selected for many generations before that. But those were generations our grandfathers and grandmothers or ancestors produced and raised. The vegetable breeders today, the ones that breed tomatoes and watermelons and cucumbers, all started with those heirloom crops. And basically they've crossbred those to have traits that make them more desirable today. Maybe they're more uniform size, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They transport better. They last longer on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
So those are characteristics that really came from heirlooms. So the heirloom genes are in every tomato that we eat, but they are different than they were three or four generations ago.
And so what's a hybrid?
A hybrid is really a cross between two varieties or two animals of the same species. If you have a Cocker Spaniel mother and a Beagle dad that produces puppies, that's a hybrid between Cocker Spaniels and Beagles. And so if you take one variety of corn and pollinate another variety of corn with those pollen, that's a crossbred or a hybrid. And hybrids are used these days mostly because they're vigorous, they're more disease resistant, and they're more uniform in the field. So you can go in and harvest those corn ears, if you will, if you're producing fresh corn, all around the same time.
Okay. So, folks, we're going to be talking a little bit more about some of the terms around farming and agriculture, including what's a GMO, what's genetically engineered, and also about some of the labels on our food. Stay tuned to the Ingles Information Aisle. Welcome back to the Ingles Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingles dietitian. I have in the studio with me today a special guest, Jack Britt. He is a former university professor with a long history of expertise in animal agriculture and
animal science.
Mm-hmm. And he's also just very well versed in a lot of areas of about farming and agriculture. And he's helping us break down some of the terminology we might see or we might hear about so that we're not afraid of these terms. So, Jack, what's the difference how would you simply explain DNA and genes to people?
Okay, DNA are the nucleic acids or the chemicals that are in each one of our cells, basically a template of how our body operates. You know, you might say that's the blueprint for operations or the operational processes. Part of that DNA comprises genes, and we all have some similar genes. Humans have almost all their genes exactly alike, except for tiny changes that might cause you to have blonde hair versus red hair or be taller versus shorter or your skin color differently. But virtually all of our genes are the same. Our genes are a little bit different than a coconut plant or a coconut palm tree. And so it's those differences that distinguish all of us and our species from each other.
I've heard really weird things like I've heard that we have a certain percentage of our DNA in common with like a banana. I mean,
you know, there are lots of genes that whether it's a plant or a bacteria or a human or an animal or any species, use the same genetic process to make a product like glucose, for example. If you're going to synthesize glucose inside the cell, the mechanism or the process is virtually the same, whether you're an animal or a plant. So we do have many genes in common because of metabolism and the way our bodies function.
So when, so plants all have certain genes, right? And
that's right.
There might be genes that cause them to be like a tomato to be a red tomato as opposed to a yellow tomato, or make some more resistant to certain diseases or hardier in certain kinds of weather, right? So they all have these
sure.
sort of
Nearly all of the traits that we see in plants are controlled by genes. A red tomato has slightly different genes than a yellow tomato, for mm-hmm. example. Genes in all plants have photosynthetic genes. Now, we don't have those because we can't convert sunlight into energy like plants.
We just convert it into a tan, right?
Into a tan, that's right. Genes also have lots of differences in their resistance to disease, whether it's root diseases or in the soil or fungal diseases on their leaves. And so one of the things that farmers and agricultural scientists are interested in are what are the genes that limit the number of diseases that plants have? Because if we can have more disease-resistant genes, we use less chemicals or processes to control those. And so one of the ways we're headed, I think, in genetics these days is to develop plants that are resistant to the diseases, resistant to drought, resistant to insects, so that they naturally are more defensive in terms of their health than the traditional plants that we've had, vegetables and fruits and so on.
So for a long time, if a farmer, say you had a farm and you had, we'll keep using tomatoes since we've kind of talked about tomatoes, and you want to have the biggest tomatoes, the juiciest tomatoes possible, you keep breeding, you find the plants that keep producing those big juicy tomatoes, and you keep trying to breed those tomatoes so they get bigger and bigger, right?
Sure. We started actually plant breeding about 10,000 years ago. The first plants were domesticated when people were at the hunter-gatherer stage and started farming. They started selecting seeds, and since then, so for the last 10,000 years, we've been improving or changing the plants that we grow. And so a farmer that's breeding tomatoes, there are actually different kinds. You may grow a different tomato if you're going to make tomato ketchup. Mm-hmm. Then you're in the fresh tomato market. If
sure.
you're selling locally in a fresh tomato market, so you're not shipping very far, you may grow a different tomato than if you're shipping farther. And if you're growing tomatoes in Florida where it's warm, you grow a different variety than is grown in Michigan, where
right.
it's cooler. So there are a lot of different varieties that are grown to meet the local growing conditions and what the customers want.
So now when we started introducing, what are some of the techniques that farmers can use now or agricultural scientists can use now to identify some of those desirable traits in plants, whether it's tomatoes or it's corn or it's soy?
Well, today, really, genetics has been revolutionized by our ability to look at individual genes and tie those genes back to specific traits. So for a plant breeder today, a tomato breeder, they will look at the tomato's entire genome, all of its DNA, and match up those pieces of DNA with the various traits, how fast it grows, how tall it is, what the yield is, what the color is, what the flavor is. And so now we can actually start doing much more effective selection because we know what genes to incorporate in that breeding, crossbreeding, if you will, to give us a better, more flavorful tomato, more disease-resistant tomato. So that's really the big push today, is to understand how the genes make a healthier and a crop, a healthier tomato, and how those are more disease-resistant and easier to grow.
And that's really having that kind of technology and being able to identify the DNA and those traits has really cut down on the amount of time it takes to get those varieties, right?
Sure. We're now being able, because we know where the genes are, to make the right kind of combinations. We probably accelerate the progress three or four fold by doing mm-hmm. that. another trick that breeders use today, since we have north and south hemispheres, we have different growing seasons, they may grow tomatoes in the north beginning in, or in the, near the equator beginning in the middle of the year and move to the north in part of the year and then move all the way to the southern hemisphere. And so they produce three crops a year.
So it speeds
and they can
it
have
up.
Three times as much progress in a year.
Yeah. Okay. We're, again, we're talking with Jack Brett about some of the things that may be confusing to you about farming and agriculture and some of the terminology. And, you know, I didn't grow up on a farm, either. So a lot of this is, I'm still learning about this process and a lot of that stuff we didn't really learn in school. So stay tuned to the Ingalls Information Aisle. Welcome back to the Ingalls Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingalls dietitian. I'm talking with Dr. Jack Brett. Jack has a long history of being an educator, teacher, also a consultant, very involved with animal science and agriculture. And we've been talking about some of the terminology that you hear and see a lot in the news. So, Jack, you know, I know you're kind of your favorite area is the dairy industry. So a lot of the things that we see when we bottles of milk, I'm just going to throw them out at you and see how you react. So when you see something like hormone-free, what do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question because my focal expertise in my research and science work was in endocrinology of livestock and animals. And so all animals have hormones. And when we say hormone-free, that's actually not possible because the animal wouldn't live without hormones, and nor would the plant live without hormones.
We wouldn't live without hormones, right?
I think what people are trying to imply is there are no artificial hormones that have been given to that animal or added to that product.
Okay.
But hormone-free is not a valid statement.
Okay. How about antibiotic-free or raised without antibiotics?
Well, those are two measurable traits, antibiotic-free, raised without antibiotics. Raised without antibiotics simply means that the calf or the pig or the animal has not received antibiotics in its lifetime. Now, there's one exception to that because if animals are sick, they can be raised without antibiotics but receive therapy when they're sick, and that is not included in that raised without antibiotics rule. And same thing with organic animals, actually. There's a clause that says they are able to receive treatments under certain conditions. So what we see in agriculture today is less and less use of antibiotics. We see more natural products being used in place of antibiotics. And if you look at dairy, for example, every farm tests for antibiotics every day before that milk is shipped to the processor.
Mm-hmm.
And only maybe one sample out of a million has any residues in it, and that sample from the milk from that farm is discarded. It cannot be sold. So no one ever consumes dairy products in the United States with antibiotics in them, regardless of what the label says. They're not permitted, and actually they're not found.
Well, and I know you visited our Milco, which
sure.
is our milk processing plant in West Asheville, and I visited a couple of the local dairy farms, and they have different processes to identify if a cow is sick. You know, I know one of them will put like duct tape around the ankle of the cow, so that they know that that milk has to be discarded. And as you said, Jack, that they do what's called a snap test, or it can be called a different kind of test.
Sure.
At the actual dairy farm before it's even loaded up onto the tanker. And then when the tanker is sent to Milco, Milco tests again down to the parts per million to make sure there's no antibiotic residue. And if there is, they put a food coloring in it. So it's like bright pink or bright,
sure.
or bright blue. And then that milk can't be sold. It can't be processed to make drinkable milk, and that's a huge financial loss for the farmer, so they don't want to do that. So.
You know, there's a real penalty on farms if they contaminate their tank or a truckload, because the farmer has to pay for that tank and that truckload, even
yeah.
all the load milk that may have come from other farms if they do that. So most farmers have standard operating procedures. They put an identification on every cow that may be treated because she's sick. She goes to a different part of the farm. She's not milked with the regular cows. Yeah. She's isolated, separated. And they always test the milk from those cows before they go back into the milking string or milking line.
Right. So we have a few minutes left. One of the things that we're seeing a lot on products these days is the non-GMO Project Verified label. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think people probably have the right to through free speech, to put any label they want, as long as it is a valid label. And you see non-GMO products on many labels where there are no GMO products for that food or that, right, that variety or that.
And we should
crop.
Say that non-GMO was supposed to mean not genetically modified organisms.
Sure.
Right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it on, and I don't know if this is going to surprise you, Jack, I've seen it on cat litter.
Sure.
Cat litter. I've seen it on salt, sea salt. I've seen it on oils, avocado oil.
You see it on items that are not even living organisms, so yeah, there couldn't be any GMO in
or
there.
Or even by processing, sure, like an oil is so processed, there's not going to be any DNA in it to see any kind of genetic material.
One of the things I've been reading about just the last few days is that if you have a dairy farm and you're feeding GMO grains, the manure from your cows can actually be used on an organic farm.
Oh, interesting.
So that seems like a contradiction, but in fact the organic regulations say it doesn't matter what kind of animal the manure comes from. It can be used as an organic fertilizer.
So here's a question I'm going to throw at you. I don't know if you can answer this. If dairy farmers had to go to eliminate all genetically engineered feed crops that they feed their animals, what would happen to the price of milk, or how would that affect the dairy farmers?
Well, based on what we know in the U.S. and around the world, if we had to shift from GMO products to non-GMO products worldwide, the cost of grains would go up significantly, at least over the first 6 to 10 years,
mm-hmm,
because you have to make the transition.
Mm-hmm.
The seeds are not available. The ways of controlling the weeds and insects and pests in those non-GMO crops are not available today. So you'd have to have an entire transition. It would be like converting all of our gasoline automobiles to diesel in the next 3 years.
Wow.
So it's that sort of phenomenon of huge change that would drive up prices for all of our foods.
Yeah. And that would affect what, I mean, right now in the United States, it's probably for a developed country, we're spending the least amount of our salaries, our income, on food than probably any other country in the world, isn't it?
That's right. We really have the most efficient agricultural system, and so we spend about 8 or 9% of our incomes on food that we purchase in the supermarket or in the markets. And that efficiency is really reflected in our productivity. Surprisingly, the U.S. actually ranks very low in use of fertilizer and pesticide compared to the rest of the world. We rank 79th worldwide in fertilizer use and 43rd in pesticide use. So there's some perception that we're a big user of fertilizer and pesticide when, in fact, we are really low. We're lower than nearly all the European countries, and many of the countries that people think have greener products than we do are way ahead of us in terms of how much fertilizer and pesticide they use.
Yeah. Well, I feel very strongly about the fact that we're so blessed in the United States to have so many amazing farmers and people who care so deeply about land and farming and animals. And we need to have Dr. Jack Brick back on again to talk more about agriculture and farming. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ingalls Information Aisle.
Thanks, Leah.